Our next case for this morning is Ashburn against Harrington, and we'll hear from you, Ms. Frade.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lauren Frade, and I represent the petitioner-appellant, Mr. John Ashburn. As this Court is aware, we have raised four issues in our brief. However, for the sake of time, I would like to focus on two of those issues, the admission of prejudicial and irrelevant weapons evidence, and the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Of course, I am happy to answer any questions Your Honors may have as to the other two issues. As for the first issue, Mr. Ashburn's Fifth Amendment right to a fair trial was violated because he was convicted of first-degree murder based on prejudicial evidence that had nothing to do with the crime. Here's what happened.
Well, I have two questions for you about this. First of all, and most importantly, all of the state courts agree with you, basically, that this evidence shouldn't have come in. It was a mistake to let it in. It wasn't sufficiently relevant, or maybe on a 403 type of analysis, the relevance was far outweighed by the prejudicial effect. But they then went further, and they said, nonetheless, in light of the evidence as a whole, the error was harmless. So my first question is, why is that evaluation of an error as harmless not something that falls inside the deference that we owe to state court decisions? The second thing is, as I read the brief discussion of why it came in, there was one impermissible, completely wrong reason that it might have been the murder weapon, obviously not so. But then there was sort of an insinuation that maybe he lost a knife and now he's gone out and replaced it. And I'm not overwhelmed by that, but it's the kind of thing that makes me think further that the deference to the state is what's due.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond to that in two parts. First, as this Court has determined in Anderson versus Stearns, habeas relief is a defendant is entitled to habeas relief where, when you look at the entire record, the admission of prejudicial and relevant evidence has substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict. And here, that's what happened.
That's, in a sense, that's a factual question you've identified. What was the effect of this wrongly admitted evidence, substantial and injurious or not? That just strikes me as a factual evaluation, is it not?
A factual evaluation must occur in order to evaluate it under habeas review, and this Court has established in Anderson v. Stearns that such an evaluation is appropriate, as has the Supreme Court in Brecht v. Abramson. So that kind of evaluation, even in the factual sense, is appropriate on the federal level. And
But for the Brecht, I mean, of course, our decisions don't count much, if not really at all. But we would have to find that the state court answer that there was no injurious effect was unreasonable, quote unquote.
Yes, that's correct. And that is what we are arguing here today. When you consider the visceral impact of a knife in a stabbing case, that is highly inflammatory. And here, when you look at the entire record, which is what Brecht requires, it would have an inflammatory effect. So let's look at some of the things that the state actually did present, or didn't present, actually. Here, we have a confession reported by jailhouse informant Earl Kelly at the exact moment when he was up for a sentence reduction, and years after this alleged conversation took place.
But what about finding Mr. Ashburn's fishing licenses and so on right next to the body? It sounds like they were both completely drunk at the time, or at least Mr. Muckenstrom was.
Yes, Your Honor, they did identify Mr. Ashburn's fishing licenses. However, when you look at the fingerprint evidence that the state was able to collect, they were not able to identify any fingerprint evidence at the scene of the crime.
That's often difficult to do. I mean, I guess a finder of fact could consider that the identification materials, the fishing license and the hunting license, whatever else it was pretty good evidence that Mr. Ashburn was right there next to the body.
And a finder of fact may have considered that evidence, and we're not disputing that evidence existed. What we are saying here is that when you look at a knife in a stabbing case, a knife that never should have been presented as it was tested and not connected to the crime, that inflammatory impact violates the Fifth Amendment right to a fair trial. That's what we are arguing here today. So we're not disputing the other evidence in terms of a license that was presented by the state. What we are disputing is that this knife evidence never should have been presented or admitted. So here what happened is you had a victim. He was found with knife wounds, but no knife was found at the scene of the crime. The police went to Mr. Ashburn's home and found two things, a buck knife, which was not connected to the murder, as shown by forensics tests, and an empty knife box purchased after the murder, as evidenced by a receipt 4 days after the crime had occurred. Neither of these items were connected, and the prosecutor knew that neither of these items were connected, yet sought to admit them anyway.
What are you worried about that would be prejudicial? That they think somehow that was the cause of the wound, or the fact that they threw the other knife away to hide the evidence and then bought a new knife? What are you worried about?
Your Honor hit the nail on the head on the first prong. The prosecutor in his closing arguments, and actually brings me back to Your Honor's second question, I apologize, insinuated that this was the murder weapon. Now, what the prosecutor did was he confused several facts in his portion of the closing arguments. So the defense counsel had no opportunity to rebut any of what the prosecutor said at this point. What the prosecutor said was, is this the murder weapon, referring to the buck knife? It could be argued that it is. What the prosecutor then goes on to state is that this buck knife, which when you read the closing, we believe he's inferring to the empty knife box, not the buck knife, might have been a replacement weapon. So we have two separate pieces of evidence here. We have the buck knife and we have the empty knife box. And it's the buck knife where the prosecutor flat out stated it could be argued that this is the murder weapon. And such a statement in a stabbing case is highly inflammatory and has a likelihood of causing a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict.
So you're essentially saying that the evidence was propensity evidence. You know, if he had this knife, he might have had another knife too, and of course the stabbing was pretty awful in this case. Let me take you over to the speedy trial point, your ineffectiveness of the counsel, because time tends to run away. My problem there is that it looks to me like the essence of the rights that he may have lost arise under state law. You know, he has this 6-month period of time before he's arraigned, but it's really state law that governs that. Under Barker, you don't really start worrying until it's a year. But from the point when he is arraigned, he's got the first lawyer, then he gets the second lawyer, then there are lots of continuance requests. And when you look at it as a whole, even if his state law rights might have been violated, I don't see where the federal violation is so obvious that you would say appellate counsel was ineffective to fail to bring it up.
Your Honor, when it comes to the federal Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial, Mr. Ashburn raised these claims in his post-conviction relief papers.
Well, but was he clear that it was federal law that he was relying on?
We believe that he was clear. So if we look at the district court habeas petition first, and we look to see what he incorporated into that petition. He states there that there was a violation of his speedy trial rights, and he incorporates by reference the underlying brief that he submitted to the Illinois Appellate Court, the Court of Last Resort. And in that brief, he cites several federal cases that analyze a Sixth Amendment speedy trial violation, including Barker versus Wingo, the United States versus Marion, United States versus Dillingham, and even an Illinois state court, People versus Belcher, that includes a Sixth Amendment speedy trial analysis.
Even if you're right, though, I mean, of course, the state's arguing procedural default, but that was the gist of the rest of my question. Is the length of the delay and the various reasons for the various parts of it so long that the state court was compelled to find that this was the strongest argument and thus that appellate counsel was ineffective?
Under Barker versus Wingo, yes, Your Honor, it was. Here, Mr. Ashburn was forced to wait for 19 months for his trial.
So what Supreme Court case are you relying on for the proposition that the delay attributable to the first lawyer with whom we'll assume Mr. Ashburn is not communicating, the lawyer's not talking to him, why isn't he nonetheless held to that? The state trial court doesn't know how frequently or not frequently the lawyer's calling the man up.
Well, Your Honor, where we have a situation where a defendant has made his demand, he made a speedy trial demand at his first opportunity to do so, when he was pro se, even before this first attorney was court appointed to him. And here, as of December 1993, the first time he was appearing in court, he made a speedy trial demand. So it was...
When did he go to prison? I didn't want to interrupt you. Where was he during all this time?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Was he in prison?
Yes, Your Honor, he was.
He went for another conviction?
Yes.
During the speedy trial expiration that you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, he was. Okay. So during these 6 months after his indictment, he was unrepresented. He was pro se, and the court in Barker versus Wingo has said that his failure to make a demand during that time period shouldn't count against him.
Right, and I'm willing to give you the 6 months, but the thing is, once you get counsel, especially it's a murder trial after all, I mean, counsel might say, you know, you've said you want your speedy trial, but we really need to do some investigation. Things happen as a case unfolds that can change the speedy trial assessment.
I agree with that, Your Honor. However, where you have a defendant who has made several demands for speedy trials, three demands up until July 1994, one in December, one in February, and one in July, it may be a situation where a court might want to check with defense counsel to make sure that those demands have been agreed to by his client. You have a client here who wants to move forward. Mr. Ashburn's letters to both Mr. Lopino, his court-appointed counsel, as well as to the court, state that he wants a vigorous defense. He wants to move forward. He wants to know what is going on, the status of discovery he's curious about, hiring a private investigator, potential witnesses. This is not a situation, as the state points to in Vermont versus Bourlon, where the defendant may not have wanted to move forward and then claim speedy trial violation. In that case, you have a defendant who fired or who basically got rid of six attorneys, where he kept firing them. One had to withdraw because he threatened their life, the attorney's life. That is not here. Here, Mr. Ashburn wanted this case to go forward. Mr. Lopino, however, did not communicate any of these delays to his client, and for that reason, we are asking this court to attribute those delays to the state, as at least one district court has recognized that where state-appointed counsel, defense counsel, causes a delay, those delays can actually be attributed to the state.
But the Supreme Court hasn't said that, have they?
No, Your Honor, but the district court in United States versus Brown, in interpreting Vermont versus Bourlon, came to that decision. So they used the Supreme Court precedent to come to its assessment in that case. So there, where you have state-appointed counsel causing a delay, that delay is actually attributed to the state. So here, where you have approximately 7 months where the state doesn't dispute that a delay, that is caused a delay, we have 6 months between the arraignment and the indictment and a one-month continuance. So there's 7 months right off the bat, state caused. And then we have another 4 months that we ask to be attributed to the state because of Mr. Lopino's failure to communicate any delays to his client.
If you want to save a minute or so for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to do that.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Ms. Kashyap.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General Gopi Kashyap on behalf of respondent. I'd like to first start by addressing the ineffective assistance claim that counsel just discussed and explain to the court that counsel has changed, petitioner has changed his theory. In the state courts and in the district court, petitioner raised an ineffective assistance allegation based solely on counsel's failure to raise a statutory speedy trial claim under Illinois law.
And but isn't it the case? I mean, it's not the clearest invocation of federal law that I've ever seen, but he's pro se a lot of the time. He's citing cases that allude to the federal right. We do try to give some benefit of the doubt to pro se litigants. So Are you arguing this because you think you would lose if we had to reach the merits, or is this just a reflexive, we're always going to argue procedural default, or what?
No, Your Honor. One point, certainly we think we're going to win on the merits themselves, but the reason we're arguing this, Your Honor, is because pro se litigants are held to at least the standards that are required under Rule 2C of Section 2254, the rules, which require a pro se habeas litigant to state in his petition the facts supporting the legal theory on which he's proceeding. And the reason for that is because district courts do a preliminary review under Rule 4, and that review requires them to look at the face of the petition to see if there's sufficient allegations to go forward. And so
in the reply brief, Mr. Ashburn outlines, or counsel on his behalf outlines, a number of ways in which Mr. Ashburn mentions the Sixth Amendment. So, for instance, footnote 2 on page 8, he demands trial pursuant to the U.S. Constitution, Amendments 6 and 14, and then he cites the Illinois statute. He also mentions it in the Illinois Appellate Court, where he's looking at cases that use a Sixth Amendment analysis. So it's not non-existent, right?
Your Honor, his citations to the federal law in those briefs on appeal are for different propositions. So, for example, he cites to Dillingham for the proposition that his arrest should have commenced the statutory speedy trial violation. In fact, in the very next sentence, he says, because of Dillingham, his 120-day period under Illinois law should have started when he was arrested. And the rest of his argument focuses on that. He cites all those cases for different propositions. And in fact, he never cites the four-factor test under Barker, nor does he apply the facts to that test. He doesn't explain the total length of delay, focusing only on the 5.5 months from arrest to arraignment. He doesn't discuss the reasons for the delay. He doesn't acknowledge his counsel's continuances. He doesn't acknowledge any prejudice. So his claim, while he may have cited some federal law, was a statutory claim. And as this court said in Verdon, you know, some claims, such as this one, speedy trial claims, may present the echo of a federal claim, but you have to do more. You have to elaborate on that and apply the facts to that.
That's a high standard. I mean, I feel like you're asking him to get a B+ in a law school crim pro class or something. We'll of course look at the procedural default issue. Has the state properly preserved this point?
Yes, Your Honor. In his habeas petition, petitioner presented. He alleged only ineffective assistance of counsel based on a statutory right. And again, he's never argued the constitutional issues, so there was no reason for us to assert a default in the state.
If we thought that you should have said something more, if we held you to the standard that you've just articulated for him, maybe we would reach the merits. Why don't you talk about the merits for a minute anyway?
Yes, Your Honor. So even if this court were to reach the merits, all the Barker factors weigh heavily against petitioner. As Your Honor pointed out, the first 5.5 months will acknowledge are attributable to the state. However, all the 13.5 months following that 5.5 months is attributable to petitioner. Vermont v. Brillen is clear, and Illinois law is also clear on this point.
Do you think, I'm troubled by this relationship that he has with his first appointed lawyer. So I'm troubled on both sides. I'm troubled on his side about what I perceive as a lack of Supreme Court authority for the proposition that state-appointed counsel's decisions not communicated to the client are attributable to the state, not to the client. That seems to me a debatable proposition at best. But on your side, I'm also troubled by the fact that somebody can be blamed for delays when he doesn't have the faintest idea why they're happening. As far as he knows, it's just the court or the prosecutor asleep at the switch.
2 points, Your Honor. Vermont v. Brillen itself, in that case, petitioner complained that counsel had not communicated with him. And yet,
complained what? I can't quite hear you. Maybe
I'm
speak
sorry,
up a
Your
little
Honor.
Bit. I want to make sure I got all that.
Sorry. In Vermont v. Brillen itself, the petitioner there complained that counsel had not communicated with him, that his various counsel had not communicated with him. And so that was part of the discussion in Vermont, and that was part of what the U.S. Supreme Court decided in stating that state-appointed counsel and acts by that counsel are attributable to the petitioner. And the second point, Your Honor, is that the reason for that is because otherwise you're creating an incentive for appointed defense attorneys to not communicate with their clients and request a bunch of continuances and then assert a speedy trial violation. And that's and as Vermont v. Berlin expressly said, that's just not something we want to do, and that's not what the speedy trial right is meant to.
So maybe the remedy, actually, if counsel is failing to communicate with the client, is actually ineffectiveness of counsel at the trial level.
Yes, Your Honor.
Different theory from what we have here.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And he could have raised an ineffective assistance claim based on that. But let's get back to the delay itself. Petitioner has no complaints about the 3 months in which counsel was litigating his petition for discharge. And it's the only issue he has is with the following 3 months in which counsel apparently wasn't communicating with him. But during that time, petitioner never insisted on an immediate trial. Petitioner talks about that he wanted a trial, but he never insisted on one. In fact,
did he write the letter to the judge complaining?
He complained about a lack of communication, and he complained about a lack of preparation, but he never stated in any of his pleadings, "Judge, I want to go to trial right now." And Barker is clear. I mean, it's the assertion of the right. And so when you don't assert the right, when you don't say you want to go to an immediate trial, it's hard to say that you really care to have a speedy trial. And so even those four months should be attributed to the petitioner. But what's even more important is when he finally did make his demand, which was in July, almost a year after his arrest, he requested every single continuance after that. His retained counsel did, and he has no complaints about that. And so, of course, he didn't want a speedy trial. And in the end, Your Honors, there's no prejudice. As Judge Mannion pointed out, petitioner was incarcerated on a different charge at the time of his arrest. And so there's no oppressive pretrial incarceration.
Some of the parts of prejudice we can assume were less of a problem. If he's already incarcerated, then he's not worrying about whether he's about to become incarcerated. That's obvious. Other aspects, you know, the ability to collect evidence and the ability to get a resolution of the second charge. This is a much more serious charge than the one he was incarcerated on. They're still there.
Sure, Your Honor, except for that he's never alleged how the delay impaired his defense in any way, shape, or form. There's no...
You mentioned that you lost a witness.
Yes, Your Honor, the state lost a witness. And I'd like to clarify one point in our brief said that...
The state lost a witness.
State lost a witness. There were two people who discovered the body, and we lost one of them in the interim.
When you say lost, does that mean they passed away?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. He was an elderly man, and he passed away. Your Honor, there's just no allegation that his defense has been hindered. And I'd like to correct one point in our brief where we said that the defendant hadn't presented any witnesses. Actually, he did present one witness, and I read it wrong and thought that the state presented it because it was an expert on fingerprint evidence. But in conclusion, Your Honor, this case is a far cry from Barker. In Barker, it was a 5-year delay where over 4 years were attributable to the state, and where 10 months, where Barker himself spent 10 months in pretrial incarceration. Yet the Supreme Court in that case, which was a much closer case, found that there was no speedy trial violation. And so in this case, where it's not even close to Barker, appellate counsel could not have been ineffective for failing to raise this claim. Unless this court has further questions.
What was the other one's name? What was the other defendant?
Barker v. Wingo is...
The other defendant's name?
In this case?
Yeah.
Clark.
Clark. And he was convicted prior to this one?
He was.
And he got 80 years, right? Thought I read that.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Your Honor. Actually, I don't
75?
Remember. I don't remember, Your Honor.
What was this person sentenced to?
Petitioner was sentenced to 75.
Okay.
So turning then quickly to petitioner's evidentiary claim, Your Honors, although this case may be disposed of on the procedural grounds discussed in our brief, it may just as easily be resolved on the merits, for the state court reasonably concluded that the evidence in this case was so overwhelming that admission of the knife evidence was harmless.
Did he ever argue that the fishing license and the hunting licenses were planted by the body?
His theory in defense was that someone may have stolen them from him and then dropped them. So the actual murderer may have dropped them. But that's just implausible, Your Honor, given his actions before and after the crime. So he threatened the victim twice this day that the victim went missing. He purchased bullets of the same caliber as that found in the victim's brain that same day. He showed off a gun capable of shooting those same caliber bullets the day the victim went missing. He shot a gun towards the victim the day he went missing while arguing with him. He was last seen with his co-defendant, Clark, leading a severely intoxicated victim towards...
I don't know why he wasn't dead from intoxication, to be honest. 0.43 blood alcohol?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think under normal standards, that would be...
It would be lethal.
Yes. However, it looks like this person drank all the time. So he may have been an alcoholic. And so perhaps in that situation, it just didn't impact him as much.
Plausibility, I mean, this whole thing is so implausible to me that I guess leaving the fishing licenses next to the dead body, I say, well, you know, that just can't be plausible. And so if there really were some kind of conspiracy and someone planted it, that these people apparently are not plausible.
No, Your Honor. I mean, it's just not a believable theory. And
what
Your Honor,
was it? This is over $37, wasn't it?
It suggests that it was all over $37, Your Honor, but
didn't pay it. So
they all were. I'm sure they were intoxicated. They had been drinking the whole day, so
yeah.
It may have been something that, whatever it was, he committed the murder and he lied to the police after when he was questioned. He washed his truck for the very first time afterwards. And just to quickly point out, yes, Your Honor, but the prosecutor may have connected the knife to the murder improperly, and the state court acknowledged that he shouldn't have done that, and it was inadmissible. But again, the significance of the knife evidence and the prosecutor's argument is just petitioner overstates it. So in closing argument, the prosecutor spent one page out of a total of 26 pages on this knife evidence, and in sharp contrast, he spent approximately 13 pages on the gun evidence and the fishing licenses and all of the other evidence that showed that petitioner was guilty, including his confession to Earl Kelly. And so
the theory is that Mr. Ashburn is the shooter and Mr. Clark is the knife wielder?
That's what he said to Kelly, and that was what the evidence pointed towards, given that petitioner had the gun and it was in his truck and he's the one that purchased all the bullets. So
would you agree that the assessment of harmlessness is, in fact, a factual determination by the state courts? I mean, they think that the trial prosecutor erred by using this knife evidence at all, actually. But then they said, but in light of the record as a whole, we think it's a harmless error.
Yes, Your Honor, and that harmless error determination was reasonable, and this court should discuss whether it was reasonable or not. Unless this court has further questions on any of the remaining issues or these issues, we would ask that the court affirm the district court's judgment, either on the merits or the procedural grounds raised in our brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Frade?
Please support. A couple quick points on rebuttal. First of all, as this court just pointed out, respondent has waived any procedural default claims by not raising it to the district court. As this court stated in Parakeet versus Briley, and as the Supreme Court has stated, as this court stated in Eichfelder versus Chandler, a procedural default is an affirmative defense that the state is obligated to raise to the district court. And where that defense is not raised, it is waived. And here, respondent never raised this defense to the district court. In fact, for the knife issue, respondent and the district court addressed the claim on the constitutional merits. For the Sixth Amendment speedy trial violation, as we discussed earlier, Mr. Ashburn did fairly present that claim as a pro se applicant to the district court. And as this court has stated, those petitions and supporting documents are subject to a liberal construction. And you just need to show a claim, show any evidence of a federal claim. And here, Mr. Ashburn did. And if you look at his reply brief to the Illinois Appellate Court, he states the following. that he was denied effective assistance of appellate counsel, where appointed counsel failed to raise the claim of the violation of the speedy trial right as described by the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. It is a clear representation of a constitutional claim. Now, even if this court doesn't determine that respondent has waived the procedural default claims, the claims were not procedurally defaulted, as we went through earlier. The claims were raised and fairly presented to the state courts through one round of review. Substantively, a couple of points to make. Respondent points to the fact that the bullets retrieved from the victim's body were the same caliber as those shot by Mr. Ashburn's guns. Notably, forensics experts were unable to confirm that those bullets came specifically from Mr. Ashburn's gun, or even from the type of gun that Mr. Ashburn owned. As for the Sixth Amendment speedy trial violation, the respondent asked this court to apply Vermont versus Berlon. As we discussed at length, those facts, those policy considerations, do not exist in this claim, where you had a defendant who was seemingly intentionally trying to delay a trial. Here, Mr. Ashburn made three demands, two demands before he appointed new counsel. He wanted the trial to go forward. Therefore, we urge that this court reverse the decision of the district court and entitle Mr. Ashburn to habeas relief under 2254. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Ms. Fraid?
Excuse me?
You were appointed by the court.
Yes, I was.
And we appreciate your assistance to your client and to the court, and our thanks to the state as well.
Thank you very much.